Welcome to the London Buddhist Centre's podcast, bringing you the Dharma and guided meditations. If you found value in listening, please consider making a donation. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Yes, you've been doing this urban retreat. What a wonderful thing to do, to practice a retreat in the midst of, as it were, your usual life, to bring some intensity and focus in the midst of everything else. I did do an urban retreat years ago in Sheffield. I've been involved with the Sheffield Buddhist Centre for a long time, and I think they sort of pioneered urban retreats up there, and it was a really good thing to do. And I got a postcard from myself after I got back to Babaloka, because we, on a certain point of the retreat, we wrote a postcard to ourselves to remind us of our practice. I was a bit, who's this writing to me, telling me what to do? Anyway, it's very, very good that you're doing that. And I like the approach you've had of beginning with an exploration of friendship, I guess, perhaps particularly spiritual friendship. I think that was your first theme, because, of course, traditionally the Dharma comes through spiritual friends. That's how you traditionally learn the Dharma. You wouldn't have, if you lived in the time of the Buddha, you wouldn't have learnt it from books. There were no books. You would meet with spiritual friends, spiritual teachers, Kalyana Mitras, lovely friends, lovely intimates, who would communicate the Dharma to you, and who you'd be with and live with and imbibe their influence. A very, very good place to start. And of course, then naturally out of that comes ethics, or as Maitreya Bandhu said last night in his excellent talk, behavior, skillful action, practicing the precepts, but really trying to, in every aspect of your life, to transform your behavior so it's more in accordance with the ideals that you have, naturally arising from that. And then, of course, there's samadhi, meditation, which is, of course, arises naturally out of skillful behavior and supports skillful behavior, as indeed skillful behavior supports samadhi. And then, of course, there's wisdom, seeing things as they really are on the basis of your friendships, your ethical practice, your deep meditation. Then you look deeply into the nature of things. The Buddha, you know, was very, very clear in his last great tour, Mahaparinibbana Sutta. In most places on that last great tour before he passed into Parinibbana at the ripe old age of 80, at most of the places he stopped, he gave a progressive Dharma discourse. Great is the fruit, great is the advantage of meditation when it's set round with, when it's supported by skillful behavior. Great is the fruit, great is the advantage of wisdom when it's set round with samadhi, with deep meditation. When there is wisdom, then there is liberation. Liberation from all negative affectivity, all the habitual tendencies, forces that bring you back again and again into the wheel of life, the cycle of life. And of course, he is a spiritual friend giving that teaching. That teaching comes from him. So you've reflected in the whole structure of your retreat, that path taught by the Buddha on his last days, as well as I've you know, had a look at the different things you've been up to, and it's a really inspiring to see all the different things that you've been doing. You know, I've heard about yoga in the park and Qi Kung, and I think, isn't there been some life drawing and painting, and I don't know. Anyway, you've been doing all sorts of things. It's a life. That's the point. The Buddhist life is a life. It's a total life. It's not a few techniques strung together. It's living the life. It's living well, living in accordance with the Dharma, with enlightenment as the end point. You notice in that little repeating of the Buddha's teaching on his last days, that after wisdom comes liberation. After wisdom comes liberation. But I have to talk about imagination. Which isn't easy, actually. Apparently I know all about it, but it's not easy because we mean all sorts of different things by this word imagination. I was thinking, for example, of a book that probably nobody reads these days by Dr. Samuel Johnson from the 18th century, The History of Rasselas, the Prince of Abyssinia. It has sort of features of the life of the Buddha in it, actually, about a young prince who goes forth. But one chapter is headed, A Dangerous Prevalence of the Imagination. You know, very 18th century Russian, a dangerous prevalence of the imagination. And it tells the story of an astronomer who gets so absorbed in watching the heavenly bodies that he thinks that he is making them move. Well, we don't mean the imagination in that sense of complete deludedness. When I was a little boy, I was often told, you've got a very vivid imagination, Richard, because I'd frighten myself, especially at night time. I'd be absolutely terrified because I was convinced. I actually convinced. I saw them. There were Daleks on the landing outside my room. You know, Doctor Who. I mean, why I watched Doctor Who, I don't know. I mean, there's years of appalling kind of nightmares and fear of the dark. I mean, obviously we don't mean the imagination in that sense of, you know, where there's very strong emotions like fear or sometimes craving or aversion, and, you know, we start inventing all sorts of possibilities. Obviously, we don't mean the imagination in that sense. And neither do we mean fantasy in the sense of daydreaming, abstracting yourself from maybe the painful reality that you're in and just sort of daydreaming. I mean, I've done so much daydreaming in my life, still do, unfortunately, and which is essentially sort of selfish, I think, and escapist. We don't mean the imagination in that way. I genuinely find it hard to talk about the imagination. In a way, it's much better to sort of have an example. Unfortunately, we had one. Samantha Vajra telling that story. I mean, I remember that, reading that story in that book, fabulous book. But I don't know about you, I was seeing tigers. He told it beautifully. He evoked the scene, the tigers, the monks, the silence of the jungle. But more than that, as well as telling a gripping story, he drew an interpretation out of it. Not a forced interpretation, it wasn't like a sort of allegory, but a very intelligent, I thought, and perceptive way of translating that imagery, that very compelling imagery, into something which is meaningful, you know, for our lives, which tells us something. I think that's what a really good image does, what the imagination does. It presents you with images which touch your emotions, touch your soul, which we don't have as Buddhists, but, you know, your heart, the eye of the heart, you know, the deeper part of you. And it gives you a meaning through the image, which it speaks more than any kind of conceptual exploration. I think the imagination does that when it's the real thing. It combines both emotion and intellect taken to a higher level. That's what can go on with an image. So that's a little bit on the imagination. But I want to go back to freedom. I want to go back to liberation. I want to go back there. And actually, it's related to imagination. You have to sort of bear with me as I sort of wind my way into this. This isn't going to be a particularly connected discourse, I'm afraid, which I think does go with the theme of the imagination. I remember when Sangharakshita gave a talk on the imagination, a very good talk called The Journey to Il Convento. He was talking about a journey through images, a sort of pilgrimage through images, particularly images of Renaissance art. And he said, well, it will be a bit of a sort of windy journey. And he quoted Yeats, from one of Yeats's poems, W.P. Yeats, "Wisdom is a butterfly, not a gloomy bird of prey." And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. We tend to think of wisdom as, oh, it's going to be penetrating and straight to the heart of things. And there is a truth in that. But I think it's also something, you know, when you're on this sort of journey, it can be laid out very, very clearly for you. But on the other hand, the journey is very elusive. It's sort of windy. You have the sort of straight path on that poster through the forest, and that's very good. But you'll probably find in your own journey, it doesn't always seem quite like that. It does feel more like a beautiful butterfly going from blossom to blossom in the garden, finding its way. So let me go back to liberation, back to freedom. And here there is an image. You know, where does Buddhism come from? Really, there's no such thing as Buddhism. That's very, very important. There are only Buddhists. And Buddhists come out of enlightenment. But enlightenment isn't an abstraction. There's no such thing as enlightenment. There's only enlightened people. Originally, there's only the enlightened person. So Buddhism, the Dharma, the truth, the path, the way, comes from a person. This is tremendously important to remember, you know, especially if you start getting lost in abstractions. You have to come back to the person. It begins with the Buddha, particularly the image I have in mind comes from one of the oldest collections in the Buddhist canon, the Udana, the verses of uplift or inspiration. That begins with discourses called the Bodhi discourses or the Bodhi tree discourses. And they start immediately after the Buddha's enlightenment. Enlightenment, awakening has happened. The Buddha, his vast, profound meditation has seen into the nature of the whole of existence without exception. And the effect is him sitting beneath the great spreading branches of a Bodhi tree. And we have to really imagine how he would have looked. Don't think of somebody in nicely laundered canary yellow robes and all golden skinned. He would have been quite dark, living out in the open, practicing all that asceticism, dark skinned, maybe quite grizzled features actually. He wouldn't necessarily have had a shaved head. He would have been wearing kind of ochre rag robes probably, that he'd sort of gathered from the burning grounds and stitched together and discoloured with mud. He would have been extremely lean, seated there in the jungle beneath this Bodhi tree. And the text says he sits for multiples of 7 days and 7 nights. 7 is a magic number. Tasting the bliss of liberation. Tasting the bliss of liberation. This is what is talked about, the vimutti sukha, the bliss of liberation, the great bliss, a bliss without any boundary, no boundary in his consciousness, this liberation from all ignorance, all negative affectivity, this sense of tremendous ease, tremendous bliss, ecstasy. He's just there, absorbed, This is really, really important. Really, really important when you contemplate Buddhism. I think bliss doesn't get the attention it deserves in Buddhist discourse and in Buddhist practice. Pleasure. The pleasure to end all pleasures. That's what the Buddha realizes. This is extremely important in our practice, that we look for pleasure. It doesn't mean that you stop practicing if there's no pleasure. It doesn't mean you give it up, but you look, you always pay attention, you know, to that satisfaction, that bliss in your practice, because that's, in a way, your juice, your rasa. That's going to enable you to keep practicing, which is something the Buddha actually discovered before his enlightenment. He realized at a certain point he'd been denying it the enjoyment of the pleasure that arose from skillful behavior, from profound meditation. And he realized the neglect of that was not doing him any good, that you actually need that as part of your experience. So he's enjoying the bliss of liberation. It's an extraordinary bliss, this, because we usually think of pleasure as something arising between subject and object, sense, experience, and so on. That's where you get your pleasure from. This is a bliss, a pleasure in which there is no subject and object. It's way, way, way out beyond our usual frameworks. So he's enjoying the bliss of liberation. Sangharakshita, our own teacher, describes the Buddha in this way as being like a kind of shaman. And in fact, in the Udanas that the Buddha uses at this time, the verses of uplift to describe his experience, he uses a very archaic word. He uses the word Brahmin, but not in its caste meaning, the priestly class. Sangharakshita feels he's referring back to a much more ancient meaning of the sort of, if you like, the holy person who goes off alone to discover special knowledge to bring back to the people. So this is the Buddha. This is where Buddhism begins. The Buddha realizing, having seen into the nature of things, seen things as they really are, particularly seen what we call conditionality, becoming, this vast becoming that there's nothing fixed, nothing unchanging, and beings are just being reborn according to their deeds, and seeing through all that, transcending all that, he enters then the bliss of liberation, and he's just absorbed. The way Sangharakshita describes it is as if he needs a period of absorbing this unprecedented, well, it's not an experience, it's beyond experience, this unprecedented whatever, you know, which, if you like, his whole being has gone over into the beyond. He then is absorbed in deep meditation, looking to discover the words, the principles that can articulate what he's seen. So this is an image, isn't it? I've told you a story. This is where Buddhism comes from. It comes from the enlightened person. If you've read a bit of Buddhism, you would have heard all about nirvana, enlightenment, shunyata, emptiness, you know, all the rest of it, mahashunyata, and on and on and on. It all gets very, very sort of heady and intellectual. But it's the person that is actually the most important. If you can have a sense of enlightenment as a person, you're approaching enlightenment more closely. A person who, as it were, becomes an image. Because after all, our highest category is personhood, isn't it? Our highest category in life is personhood, because we're persons. And I don't know about you, but this person, thinks they're the most important person in existence. I don't think I'm alone with that. You know, even if I'm giving myself a hard time, I'm still the most important person. I treat myself very, very well, actually, even if I'm doing things which I shouldn't be doing. I'm still extremely important to me. So to endow enlightenment with personhood, to see liberation as a person, is an inner person, you're endowing it with the most sacred, actually. People sort of wonder why, where, how the Buddha image comes. But, you know, you get some people thinking, oh, it's a falling away. This is, you know, people thinking that, that you know, the Buddha was a sort of Protestant and, you know, so making Buddha images is a terrible sort of weakness of his disciples. It's not. It comes out, actually, of the experiences of early Buddhists who have the experience of coming close to enlightenment by recollecting their teacher, by recollecting the Buddha, by bringing the Buddha to mind. There are beautiful stories in the old texts of in one case, a very, very old man, you know, who met the Buddha in North India, and then moved back probably to somewhere in Maharashtra state, I think sort of south of the Godavari, I think the text says, so if those of you who know your Indian geography. And he's talking to a friend about the Buddha, about this amazing teacher who showed him how the way things are, who showed him the path and so on. And this friend said, well, why aren't you with him? You know, if he's so good, you know, why aren't you with him all the time? He said, well, I'm old. You know, I can't get up there. I can't walk up to North India. But he's with me all the time. All night, all day, he's in my mind. I'm meditating on him. You know, my aspiration flows towards him. His sense of enlightenment is close to him because he brings to mind the Buddha. So this tradition of Buddha images comes out of that experience. It comes out of that deep human experience of bringing to mind that person you most revere. Perhaps, you know, you've got have some sense of this, you know, when you love somebody very, very much, very, very much, you know, they're in your mind. Sometimes that can be extremely painful, but imagine that it's a different kind of relationship, a relationship with a teacher or a spiritual friend. Of course, they're going to be there. They're going to be in your mind. I daily think of my own teacher. I bring him to mind, not out of attachment. He's gone, you know, he's in the sense of, you know, he died some years ago. But when I bring him to mind, I feel more deeply in touch with my spiritual practice. So this is what it was like for those disciples of the Buddha. So the imagination in this sense, in the sense of recollection, in the sense of memory, plays a huge part in Buddhist practice. You know, right from the earliest days, you know, going right back to the time of the Buddha. It's interesting that the Buddha himself, his experience of enlightenment was so deep, so profound. The texts tell us that he was reluctant to communicate it at first. You find these sort of, in the old texts, these passages where you get a sort of insight into enlightened consciousness. And you find him meditating and reflecting. This truth is so profound, it's so deep. Gambhira is the Sanskrit word, Pali word. It's so deep, so profound, so subtle. It can only be seen by the wise. But this generation, that's the phrase he uses, they're so attached. And if I try to communicate it to them and they don't get it, that would be so wearying. So maybe I'll just stay here in my freedom, in my liberation. And we tend to think, well, how could he possibly think he's enlightened? You know, how could that? But actually, it, again, it's deeply human. You know, you probably know yourselves. If when you've had finer feelings, deeper feelings, insights, responses, and maybe you try to share them with a friend or within the family, even somebody you thought you were close to, and they kind of just don't get it, or they, you know, or what are we watching tonight, or you know, they get cynical. It's extremely painful, isn't it? It's really, really hurts and really frustrating. So on an infinitely higher level, that's what you have with the Buddha. So you have this image of the Buddha really wondering about whether to teach, and here the mythology starts to emerge. You know, there's a lot of mythology in the old texts. It said that a great god, not the creator, nothing like that, a conditioned being, a sort of divine being named Brahma, who has a kind of responsibility for the world, he sees this happening, and he thinks, this can't happen. He can't do this, because the world is perishing, the people are perishing. In the words of the Bible, that's not in the Pali canon, without vision, the people perish. Without vision, the people perish. Fabulous phrase, that, isn't it? Without vision, the people perish. And don't we know it? We're perishing. So he entreats the Buddha to teach. Look again. Look again. There will be people who see. And again, we have an image. It says that the Buddha looks at the whole world, looks at beings with his, the detail significant, his Buddha eye. You get lots of different eyes in Buddhism, not just the fleshly eye. You have the divine eye, which comes through deep meditation, you know, where you can sort of see from far away and so on and so forth. You get the Dharma eye, and you also get the Buddha eye. So this is enlightenment looking. And when you say Buddha eye, it means we can't really know what's seen, because enlightenment is a takavatra, beyond the sphere of reasoning. And it's very, very interesting when the Buddha looks out and sees us, sees living beings. The way he describes it is in poetry. It's metaphor. He says, it's as if there's a great lake of lotuses, red and white and blue. Some are buds immersed in the water. Some are pushing up out of the water. Some are unfolding. This is his vision of living beings, that they're like these lotuses growing up out of the mud. In other words, he sees us as living and growing beings with an affinity for the sun of enlightenment. I mean, it's a very, very powerful image in India. In India, you see lotus ponds. I mean, they are extraordinary, because lotuses seem to love the muddiest, most stinking black ooze, brown ooze as possible. And they just beautify it. They just sort of float up like visions, you know, hovering and dazzling above the water. With great beauty. So the lotus, us, all of us, becomes a symbol of purity, beauty, growth, potential, emerging potential for Buddhahood. And at that moment, when the Buddha sees that, his compassion flowed forth. But of course, it's a very particular kind of compassion. It's not in any way like pity. It's not feeling sad, others' sadness. It's a vigorous a vital response to us, to our emerging potential. One of the words for compassion that is used frequently in the Buddhist tradition is anukampa, which means something like to shake with. Kampa is shake or vibrate or tremble. Anukampa is to shake with, to vibrate with. The way I see this particular image, this particular vision from the old text, the Buddha's full enlightenment is resonating with, vibrating with, trembling with our emerging potential for enlightenment, our individual potential for enlightenment. So compassion is something incredibly energetic and inspired and ecstatic, because immediately, as soon as the Buddha sees this, he's out there. He's leaving the jungle. And some of the later writers, again, piling on the sort of imagery, they say when he leaves the jungle to go and walk the dust roads, the elephants start trumpeting, the tigers and lions start roaring, the birds start singing, because something really good is going to happen. Something really good is going to happen. So the Buddha is off communicating to us, communicating his liberating Dharma to us, putting us in touch with that potentiality. So a lot of imagination, I think, a lot of imagery, certainly, in the Buddha's enlightenment and the Buddha's communication. But in a way, what does that mean for us practically now? I think there's two areas I want to talk about in relation to our own, let's call it imaginal yoga, imaginal practice, imaginal action, let's call it that. The first actually just carries on from what I said about the early Buddhists recollecting the Buddha. You can make a practice of imagining the Buddha. Anybody can do that. Anybody can take up a practice of imagining the Buddha. I mean, we celebrate here, I don't know if you've had puja during your urban retreat, devotional practice.
Tomorrow.
Yippee. We'll come to that. Because puja, worship of the Buddha, is actually an imagining of the Buddha. And in a way, what you imagine yourself as is a disciple of the Buddha. It's as if you are with the Buddha. So one writer talks about recollection of the Buddha, imagining the Buddha as a pilgrimage into the past. It's a sort of drama where you imagine yourself as coming across the Buddha, and you do the beautiful, typical, wonderful, courteous Indian practice of bowing as you would to any honoured guest, not particular enlightened being, any honoured guest, of bowing and making offerings of flowers and lights and incense and expressing verses of honour and even commitment and even chanting some praises. So you've got an opportunity to enact, because imagination, it's not just in the mind, it comes into behaviour, into action. We've done a bit of it already this evening, haven't we, with the standing up and saluting the shrine. That's imaginal yoga. There you are. As soon as you do that, the Buddha is present. The Dharma is present. The Sangha is present. Those are mantras we chanted. They're words of power, words of truth. So come and do that tomorrow. So you can practice this. And one of the things that you're doing, in a way, you are sort of projecting, because some people say, oh, hang on, aren't you projecting? Isn't that a bad thing? You know, some stuff out there. Well, of course you are, because you're not enlightened. You have the potential for Buddhahood, but you're not in touch with it fully. It's nascent. It's actually longing to emerge, because it's the deepest part of ourselves. So seeing the Buddha, as it were, outside, is putting you in touch with the Buddha inside. It's drawing Buddhahood up in you to inspire you in your mindfulness of breathing, in your metta-bhavana, in your ethical practice, in your study and understanding of the Dharma. So great, you've got some imaginal yoga tomorrow with some puja. So that's that way, they're sort of, as it were, looking upwards, being drawn up. So there's another thing you might notice as you enter into those things. You start noticing, hang on, there's a bit more going on than me here. But I'll let you, I better not say too much. I don't want to predict how it is. What time is that? Maybe I'll come along and have a watch.
Tomorrow?
Yeah.
Nine.
Okay.
9:30?
Yeah.
If it starts today, there's a poo.
It's obviously happening outside of time. But there's another way in which we can talk about the imagination, I think. And that's in relation to one another and to all others. It's using the word imagination in a slightly different way. Can you remind me of your name?
Satchamani.
Sorry?
Satchamani.
No, right.
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Suvarna Jyoti.
I'm very sorry, Suvarna Jyoti. I'm nearly 67, so that's my excuse. Suvarna Jyoti, you said a wonderful thing, I thought, about the imagination being an extraordinary faculty of our minds. I think, didn't you say something like that? A wonderful, I thought that was so important to appreciate that and understand that. And one of the things we can do as human beings is imagine ourselves as another, as one another. And this becomes a very, very important practice in Buddhist tradition. And of course, it's not just in Buddhist tradition, it's throughout. You know, it's throughout the world, this whole idea of what they call the golden rule, treating another as you treat yourself, giving another the same respect and reverence as you would yourself, the same care and attention as you would yourself. This is really taken up very, very strongly in Buddhist practice and training. It's actually the foundation of the metta-bhavana, the development of loving-kindness. When you do the metta-bhavana, it's, yes, bhavana does mean making to become. You know, you're making to become that love. It's a creative act. But all creative acts, the creation of love, come out of imagination. And what you're doing in the metta-bhavana, one of the things you're doing is, in the first stage, is realizing that you're extremely important to yourself. You know, I know a lot of people have trouble with the first stage, you know, I don't like myself and all that sort of thing. Personally, I've never had a problem with that. But that's just because I'm a massive egotist. Anyway, that aside, we are very important to ourselves. Extremely important to ourselves. However we behave, we're actually doing it. Sometimes it might be very misguided to make ourselves feel all right, to feel protected. This is the language that Buddhist tradition uses. Very interesting, isn't it? That it acknowledges that we can feel insecure and frightened. You know, that's a deep part of the human condition. So, of course, we want to protect ourselves, care for ourselves. We don't want to feel frightened. We want to feel well. We want to feel secure. We want to be treated well. Of course we do. You know, of course we want to be treated well, with respect and courtesy. And what you're doing in that first stage of the metta-bhavana, you're sort of becoming a friend of yourself. You have to sort of imagine, if you like, that you are a good friend of yourself. I mean, it can sound a bit strange, but you have to sort of perhaps imagine that you are your protector, that there's even something in you that is your protector, that cares for you, that wishes you the deepest happiness and well-being. So that's what you're doing in the first stage. Then in all the other stages, it's much easier in the second stage. you're realizing that every single person in that meditation is exactly the same. They want to be well, they want to be protected, they want to live. They want to live well. So why don't I extend my love to them? Why don't I then become their protector? Why don't I for a while forget about myself? I've done some work on myself, so now why not forget about myself for a while? Why not put myself in the place of another, that friend, that acquaintance that I see perhaps every day, that, yes, even that enemy, we use the euphemism now, the difficult person, not realising, of course, in Buddhist tradition, the difficult person is us. We're the difficult person, actually. If we have ill will to somebody, we are difficult. But anyway, let's not get into that. The difficult person, the enemy, yes, even to them. Try to understand them. Try to realise, well, actually, they also want to live well. You actually don't need any information about another person, actually any other living being, to love them. Don't need any information at all. All you need to do is tune in, resonate with their living beingness. You're a living being. They're a living being. You need no information to love. You really need no information. You just need to have this attitude of, I want to be well. I want to avoid suffering. I don't want to be sick. I want to feel protected. Look at the people on the tube. They are exactly the same. So extend that sense of protecting them. In one famous description of this kind of meditation, the great Shantideva, he keeps using this refrain. So what is so special about me that I live for my own happiness and not for the happiness of others? What is so special about me? Keep saying it. What is so special about me that I don't extend an attitude of protection and love to all others? He goes even further and starts talking about all living beings as being like parts of a sort of vast body. You know, he says, well, our body is made up of parts. Actually, the whole body of the world is made up of these parts. When something hurts in our arm or finger or knees, we immediately try to protect it. So in the same way, why not? Why not protect wherever the suffering is? So this is a very, very deep practice, but you have to use your imagination. He gets very, very radical. I'm not suggesting you do this at home, but he even sort of selects people who really hate him. He's thinking of sort of brother monks in Nalanda, you know, sort of rivals and seniors and younger ones who resent him. And he sort of said, why? I'm going to imagine myself as them, looking back at me critically in order to love them and understand them. I'm not suggesting you do that. That's a later esoteric practice. But you can see the act of the imagination. And what he's doing, of course, is testing himself. Because it's sort of easy to love. You know, you sometimes see it in the last stage of the Metta Bhavana, people sort of blissing out. I love humanity, you know. I love all beings. I love you all, you know. But of course, when it comes to the reality of the difficult person or somebody in the family who starts acting up, well then, you know, that love, you know, starts to wilt in the face of that. So this is where we have to practice this vigorous, imaginative yoga to identify with others, to identify with all others. Shantideva says, if you master this, if you become one of those who master this kind of practice of identifying with all others, and he's talking about a bodhisattva, that's somebody who's working for the enlightenment of all beings, not just working on their own practice, but really doing everything they can to alleviate the suffering of the world around them and to bring onto the path all others, ultimately. He says, people who practice like this, who in a way forget about themselves and live for others in this very, very positive way, they feel no elation at success when things go well, when people respond well, and no despair at failure when people reject them. Such people, he says, become like geese entering into a pond of red lotuses when they enter the hell of unending suffering. This is what he said. In other words, they don't see hell. They don't see suffering in that way. They've got an entirely different perspective on others, on life. Their love is all-pervading. They don't mind what they do. But it comes out of these deep, profound, imaginal leaps to identify with the other, which is extremely difficult practice, but that's what we're aiming for. And I think that you can have a sort of taste of it. And I've got to sort of finish here. Here you are on this urban retreat, nearly at the end of it, and then you'll just go back into urban, presumably. But maybe try to pretend that you're bodhisattvas, just for a few days. Pretend that you're going to practice in a different way. There's another very famous text describing the bodhisattva practice. And in this particular text, the person teaching, a character named Vimalakirti, says that bodhisattvas, if they're the real deal, if they really are people on this path, you know, coming out of this profound identification with others, living out of this vigorous love and wisdom and understanding, they really can't be troubled by anything. In fact, if they're troubled, it can only be another bodhisattva who's hassling them. It can't be anything other than a bodhisattva who's giving them a hard time. So, if that difficult person is really giving you a hard time in your workplace, in the family, a neighbour, you're a bodhisattva. You're training me in developing patience and love. Thank you very, very much for being so difficult to me. You know, it goes on like this. So, you know, all the people who sort of tempt you and give you a hard time, all those horrible politicians, I'm sure you've got your favourite ones who you really, really hate, they're just bodhisattvas. They can't be anything else because you're so elevated in your own spiritual practice. So, yeah, use those situations as a way of transforming your engagement with life, because it is hard, isn't it, in the city. I live in a beautiful country retreat centre in Norfolk, and, you know, the only kind of problems we have is, well, they're so petty as to be ridiculous and you wonder about it. But here, I mean, I don't know what was going on this afternoon, you know, but the sirens this afternoon, I was trying to meditate, you know, the sirens going up and down the road. And I think, crikey, people have to live with this every day. Incredible. So, you know, and I must admit, I was having a bit of trouble thinking of those sirens as the sort of chanting of mantras of bodhisattvas. But anyway, I'm sure you can do better because you actually live here and I don't. So I wish you well. Well done for doing the urban retreat. And I wish you well going on in your rich Buddhist practice, your imaginal yoga of living this life. So remember these two things. Imagine the Buddha for inspiration. The Buddha is the embodiment of the kind of life where nothing troubles you. Nothing troubles you. Whatever is trouble is transformed onto the path. Well, in the Buddha's case, it's just transformed into enlightenment. And practice, the imaginative practice of really treating others as you would treat yourself and revering them and respecting them and reaching out to them and protecting them as you would protect yourself, and encouraging them to flourish and grow in, well, in love and in the Dharma. Thank you.